Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. My name is Vivian Roberts, co-founder and artistic director of ANIF Contemporary. It is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Carmini Velody, who will be talking to painter Alistair Gordon about his practice described in the title Quadlibet for his forthcoming solo exhibition at 12 Piccadilly Arcade this September. Carmini Velody is a writer and artist and senior lecturer in philosophy, theory, and history of art, and director of research at Edinburgh College of Art at the University of Edinburgh. Her research intersects 20th century and contemporary continental philosophy and theory, and theories and historiographies of art history and visual culture. She is the author of Tintoretto's Difference, Deleuze, Diagrammatics, and Art History, published by Bloomsbury in 2019, and is series editor of Refractions at the Borders of Art History and Philosophy for Edinburgh University Press. She studied painting at the Royal College of Art and Chelsea College of Art and holds a PhD in philosophy from the Centre for Research in Modern European Philosophy, Middlesex University. Alistair Gordon is a London-based artist and artist-in-resident for City and Guilds of London Art School in 2020. Gordon is co-founder and director of Morphe Arts and course leader for critical and professional development at the Leith School of Art in Edinburgh. After his selection for the Open West 2014, Gordon went on to receive first prize in the Shoesmiths Art Prize. That year, he was also selected for the Threadneedle Painting Prize, Zeitgeist Open, Oriel Davis Open, and BEEP 2014. Since then, solo exhibitions have included Without Borders, online at Aleph Contemporary, First Things Gallery in New York, the Amundsen Collection in Los Angeles, Nomus Projects in Dundee, and group shows including CCE Gallery in Beijing and Paint Lounge Sluice in Berlin. Gordon's work features in several international collections, including the Landmark Trust PLC, London, Amundsen Collection, Los Angeles, Simmons & Simmons, London, Royal Bank of Scotland Collection, Glasgow School of Art Alumni Collection, and the Beaux Arts Trust, London.
So it's great to talk to you about these works that you have in the upcoming show. And I think we have to start with the title and asking you
Quadlibet,
this title, Quadlibet. Why have you chosen it?
Thanks, Camille. Good morning. Yes, quadlibet is a philosophical term, and it's a variant on quilibet, which means what you will from the Latin, later to the French. And in an historical sense, in an ancient sense, the quadlibet was a philosophical exercise. So it meant a proposal for a series of ideas to be discussed. And one would talk about a series of quadlibets, lectures, and philosophical musings. So, you know, anything from being around the Areopagus in ancient Athens to sitting around your kitchen table debating at 2 o'clock in the morning with tea and toast. That would be a quadlibet. But the term developed into a musical idea in the 19th century. And I suppose in some ways it might be like an early form of jazz with musicians sitting together, laying down a line of melody that was pleasing, and then another improvised line thrown on top. And then it enters into visual language late 17th, 18th century, I think, as a form of laying down images or ideas, almost like a collage. And there are artists like Edvard Collier who developed that practice, and Gilbrecht who developed that practice as well. So essentially it's a kind of visual philosophical musing that presents like a collage, but when you look closely, it's actually very carefully painted.
Mm-hmm. And are those interrelations between the metaphysical, the musical, and the visual important for you?
Yes, they are, in a sense. My work's often had a connection to music, and I listen to a lot of music when I paint. And in the show Quadlibet, some of the paintings riff on certain musical terms. You know, one painting is titled Improvisation, for example. Another is B flat. And I am a musician of sorts. I play guitar, I play violin, I sing. a little. So there's a connection in the work between musical rhythms and musings. You know, and historically one thinks of great artists like Paul Klee and Mondrian, who referred to a musical tradition in terms of vibration, movement, tone, modality, and how that connected in turn to certain marks or rhythms or tones in painting. Yeah, so certainly more than musical, maybe a little towards the metaphysical. I go a little bit out of my territory if I was to talk about the metaphysical, but in a philosophical sense, how a line, a mark, a colour might resonate with something beyond the material of the painting itself, or beyond the surface to something beyond. You know, I think in that sense towards like Mark Rothko, for example, the surface that leads to somewhere beyond, a void perhaps, or a rhythm beyond the painting itself. So yes, in a sort of quadlibet menagerie of ideas thrown together, all these things might interconnect.
And how did you come to this genre or this approach? Was it that realism, an idea of realism, had always been an interest for you, or was it a sort of, you know, something you discovered in art history or through reading? How did it emerge?
I suppose, in honesty, I kind of stumbled into it, really, as often the best ideas come about in that way. And I was doing an exhibition in East London shortly after I graduated from my MA, and this was 2012. And I'd asked a friend to write a little piece about that exhibition. I'd been making paintings of artifacts from a nautical tradition, sailors' maps, notes from sailors' diaries and so forth. And I painted them to appear as though they were pinned onto a wooden substrate. And my friend came to the studio, we looked at it together, and he mentioned this term quadlibet, and it was new to me. And so, you know, but due diligence, and I researched it and came across this rather wonderful and interesting form of, well, it's an illusionistic, heightened realistic approach to painting that very much connected with what I was trying to achieve. And unlike other forms of trompe l'oeil, trick of the eye, which often take on something like a sweeping vista or the illusion of a window to look onto a landscape or a painted ceiling that takes us to the transcendent or heavenly realm, the quadlibet was painted onto flat surface to appear like a letter rack or perhaps even like a tabletop. So it was a very flat relief, and that resonated with my painting. And they also had a sort of political edge. So some of the quadlibet painters were montaging and collaging images that were highly politicized, an attack on a king's speech, for example, or a reformer's leaflet, or an anti-aristocratic leaflet. So really, I owe a debt of gratitude to my friend who introduced me to this term. And, you know, I've sort of been riffing on it ever since.
I mean, that's, you know, interesting that it's, you know, it has this distinctive place within the genre of trompe l'oeil, and that, as you say, you know, I mean, as I understand it, you know, and do correct me, so the quadlibet, you know, in the sort of 18th century, you know, northern, really talking about sort of specific groups of objects, domestic objects, often with a relation to letter writing.
Yes.
And also the sense of a kind of trance, you know, assemblage, you know, on a surface. And as you said, that kind of flatness, that it's, you know, so it's, you know, there's not much sort of depth of field there. We're on a wall, or we're on a sort of table lifted up or something like that. And I suppose the intimacy and the privacy of that space, that is, you're kind of given a window into someone's study or bureau or private notes or private exchanges, that is, that something that marks it out for you from other branches of hyperrealism and trickery, visual trickery?
Yes, I think this is a really good observation, Kamini, that it's a very intimate portrait of a sort, a quadlibet painting. As you say, it looks like it could be someone's desk. They've been writing a letter. and you peer literally into their letter and see the writing. So in a way, it's like reading someone's personal correspondence or a diary. You know, today we all send out our personal thoughts on Twitter and Instagram. You know, we all get to read them. But back then, that was a very personal correspondence. So there's something about the intimacy of the Quodlibet painting that is at odds to the larger, perhaps more bombastic scale of the other forms of trompe l'oeil, that mural painting taking over a whole wall, for example, or as I was talking about the ceiling. And one thinks about, you know, those wonderful paintings, particularly in Rome, in the Jesuit church in Rome, where you look up to a transcendent realm and the illusion of a dome above you. And, you know, the effect of that trompe l'oeil is to really put you in your place. You know, you sit underneath the power of the realm above you, and you know where your station is. But with the Quodlibet painting, you approach it almost like a peer. In fact, more than that, it reveals a secret to you. So you very much have the power. And I think within the realm of the trompe l'oeil, your Quodlibet is distinctive in that it gives the power, the presented power is to the reader, the viewer, rather than to the artist or the commissioning body of the trompe l'oeil. So I think for that presents itself to me in a more contemporary sense, you know, as we think about perceptions of power, particularly in painting and in images and so forth. And that for me is a very interesting kernel of Quodlibet that takes it into a more of a contemporary conversation.
Let's turn to the paintings. And I mean, would you say, so there's six paintings or so in the show, and are they all Quodlibets for you? And how are they Quodlibets, actually?
I'd say with the exception of one, which is a sort of cheating Quodlibet, perhaps. I think there may be seven or so, I think, finally, that we've put together in the show. And the Quodlibet is so it's as if you're looking on a surface. And if we take, for example, the painting Improvisation, and here we're looking at an MDF surface. So it looks a little bit like perhaps a drawing board that you might encounter in an artist's studio. And on top of that, we have the illusion of paintings that look like they're halfway through, perhaps various levels of completion. They appear to be taped with masking tape, cream color, yellow. And then there's the representation of an olive branch and notes and various other artifacts. Now this in a way is almost a kind of classic rendering of Quodlibet, you know, stuff that appears to be taped or pinned onto a surface. And most of the paintings follow that trajectory and that rhythm. It's worth saying that for those who are new to my work that everything on the surface is painting. It feels almost embarrassing to say that, but people do ask, is the masking tape painted as well? But it's all painted. But distinctive from that would be the painting titled Bewitching Hour, The Bewitching Hour, which is actually the painting on the back wall here of my studio. So it's quite a large painting, 240 centimeters across. And here we have a different sort of illusion. Here the illusion is as if we're looking through a glass window out into some form of landscape. So we see silver birch trees, actually, and there's a sense of movement and urgency with the trees, as if we're running to them or running from them, perhaps an illusion of fire or wind or something like that. And that's an unusual form of Quodlibet. Quodlibet is a very flat relief, but here we're looking through a window and beyond to a landscape. So that takes things further. But at the same time, there's the impression of drawings, A4 pieces of paper, tape, perchance even my studio cat, Mortimer, who's there trying to pull down a piece of tape that looks like it's been put onto the glass surface. So yes, some classic Quodlibet, but then something a little beyond, something more towards the idea of a screen or a glass pane.
That's interesting. I mean, they're all, I suppose the distinctive thing that immediately comes to mind is all of them, perhaps with the exception of Jacob's Dream, are landscapes. Paintings of landscapes, paintings of landscapes. And that's not a genre that sort of typically features in trompe-l'oeil or in quadlibet, obviously. So yes. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. And Jacob's dream is distinctive in that, isn't it? Yes. So we have here paintings that are replications or reproductions of other historical paintings. And this was a painting that I completed in 2020, perhaps. And it connected with an earlier body of work that I made actually a few years ago in 2017 for an exhibition just outside of Los Angeles, actually. And while that Jacob's Dream wasn't part of that show, it became a series of work that was made beyond that and after that work. But the central section of that piece is a painting of Jacob's ladder, angels ascending and descending. And that's a kind of landscape, if you will, a sort of transcendent or heavenly landscape. And that opened the possibility for me of landscape painting. And you're right, quadlibet wouldn't necessarily be landscape painting, but of course these are paintings of landscape paintings. So in a way, they're still within the still life genre. You know, it's a painting of a painting. Yeah. So it's a landscape painting, but it's also a form of still life. So the trick is still there, I think.
Yes, because of course, you know, quadlibets are, and I'm thinking you mentioned Cornelius Schiebrex earlier, didn't you? But these
yes.
are things that are very much about painting, about
yes.
limits of painting, about representation. There's that famous painting of the back of a painting, isn't there?
Yes.
Yes. So these are paintings that are, you know, the earliest, in a way, metaphysical comments on the nature of painting examining its own limits. And in that yes. sense, you know, your paintings of landscapes, what you're saying, what you're suggesting is that the genre of landscape might be important, although let's come back to that, because I'd like to probe you on that. But then the comment on painting, the kind of, you know, meta discourse, if you like.
Yes. Yeah, I've become increasingly curious about genre of landscape painting and, you know, having for the last couple of years drawn my attention more towards still life, but had something of an intuitive sense towards the landscape. And I used to paint landscape when I was a student, and I studied in Edinburgh and I studied in Glasgow, and I had very pleasurable afternoons in the landscape, you know, in the Pentland Hills, just outside of the city, and painting. And yes, I've often been curious about that, how that fits in a contemporary sense. You know, can you still be a painter who goes out into the landscape and paints from observation in the landscape and then come back to the studio? And of course, in the last year, when none of us have really been able to have much mobility, the landscape has been more of an appealing idea. But I mostly observe the landscape through mediated lens. You know, it's through the laptop, it's through photograph, and this is a very different experience from that sublime experience of the 19th century landscape painter, you know, who goes out to commune with nature and has that sense of awe and wonder and attempts to recreate that on the surface of the canvas in some way. And yet, you know, today we tend to experience the landscape, well, those of us who live in the city, we experience it more through digital means, you know, through movie or through photograph, or we drive through it on holiday. And that sublime experience of the landscape is very different for us. When I was a boy, we used to go on holiday in Wales, and we used to climb to the top of Snowdon Mountain, you know, and have that experience of the climb and the effort. And historically, one would climb Snowdon and reach the top and perhaps sing a hymn. But now you go to the top and there's a cafe. So you sit and you have a cafe latte and then you can get the train back down again, you know, and the landscape doesn't have that same imposing element perhaps that it would have done historically. So these new paintings that evoke a sense of landscape are a way of bringing that idea back into the landscape, that inquiry about how we perceive landscape today. I'm a studio painter. But these paintings were made in part through being out and painting on the common. I have a portable easel. I went out for several mornings and painted and drew from observation in landscape, and then brought those material studies back to the studio and painted the observations of the landscape, if that makes sense. So they are both landscape and still life, a reflection on both of those coming together. So they're quite curious hybrid sort of paintings, I suppose.
It's interesting, that sort of comment. I mean, you sort of, the notion of inquiry, which takes us back to the dissertation and the sort of, you know, trying to vocalize or you know, argue or test the limits of something through kind of through a discourse on the thing, and whether we name that still life or landscape. But it's interesting then, of course, the other element of the melancholic element there, or the sense of loss, and also the romantic character, I suppose, of this group of paintings here, which is the you know, these are mediated representations of something lost and recovered, lost and represented in a way that one might, I wonder, you know, sort of emphasizes that loss. So the fact that they are tapeable and frameable things on a board, to me, maybe that's not, it's both a sort of comment on the process of painting, but it's also a sort of comment, as you just sort of indicated there, maybe on the frameability, the representation of, you know, of landscape, that it is something that's containable as an idea mediated through other types of experience.
Yes, that idea of the loss and the melancholy, it's I think that's important, and it relates to the process of painting. As you say, these are paintings very much about the process of painting in itself, and the still life. Still life is, you know, it's natura morte, isn't it? You know, dead nature, and the conundrum of when one paints something, the moment you paint it, you know, it is both animated because you are animate when you paint the thing, but when it's complete, it is then still, and it will stay as thus and forever. So there's the sense that it is both animate, but it's dead at the same time. And when one makes a painting of landscape, you know, one is there and in the landscape and animated and responsive, and it's wonderful and exhausting. You do feel very much alive. But then when it comes back to the studio and it's painted as something taped or pinned onto the board, that quietens down that sense of animation. And there's the loss and the memory and the memento of that experience. I find it hard to articulate, and that's why I paint it, and why I need people like yourself, Gamini, to painters need writers and philosophers to help us process what we're doing. But for me, there's something very intuitive about the gestural painting that's made in the moment with animation and intuitively, and then what happens when it's painted quietly and still in the studio, where you're listening to the radio and surrounded by comfortable materials. And somehow it sort of oscillates, it flits between being both animated and lamentful and stopping and still at the same time. And I think for me, it's that sort of oscillation, that flitting, how painting can have two things that shouldn't exist at the same time, but somehow they manage to coexist on the surface of painting. Both animated and dead, intuitive and realism, that these things somehow coexist together.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing, isn't it, to sort of reproduce, as you say, spontaneity. To reproduce not only experience, like experience of being immersed in a landscape, but to reproduce the very life of painting.
Yes.
So then becomes a comment on its...
Yes. Death. Yes, well, indeed, if I think of the painting in the show titled Pink Dawn, And on this painting, this is a painting that's, in some ways, actually, it's not so much a replication. So I began with the pink and the blue surface on the background, which in a way might represent a studio wall, perhaps, that's been stained through time. And then on top of that, we have the illusion of the masking tape. And the whole thing looked as if a studio wall has been presented and staged. And then I painted the rectangle in the middle and took the whole thing out to Wimbledon Common early morning, and then painted the dawn on top of the illusion of the studio wall. So in some ways, this is a bit of a flit. And then a similar experience with other paintings in the show, Elements of Improvisation. This happens as well. There are partner paintings to that too. So in a way, it's not an illusion, because with this painting, with New Dawn, the painting in the middle is the painting made in response to the rising dawn out on Wimbledon Common. So it's not a painting of a painting. It is in itself a quote unquote authentic painting of the dawn. So, so there are some playful elements there between the illusion and the real, fake and the not fake, the intuitive and the painting in response to the mark.
It's interesting. I mean, the kind of that constant pull and push of the sort of the joke, the trick, the illusion, and the sincere, the real experience, the limits of the real. I mean, I'm thinking of Baudrillard now, and you know, that great essay he wrote on Trompe l'Oeil, you know, which he always talks again and again about the banality of the objects. But he's talking about still life, you know, he really is. So he's not talking about the quadlibet, I don't think, but you know, the banality of the objects signaling the, you know, their death, the kind of the moment they're frozen, and therefore, you know, the signal of their absence, if I remember correctly. But he, you know, he says something about these painted objects as ghosts on an empty stage. They're ghosts, yes. Because yes. They are signs, they're empty signs of existence that's past, yes, and therefore contained, and therefore representable,
yes,
in a particular way. But it seems that that's not entirely the way, you know, you know your approach is more complex than that, both in your choice of objects, but also in your investment of your own experience as artist in the world, being in the world.
Yes, I remember reading that essay as a student, and the thought of the painting as a ghost, and I think he may also describe a painting like a relic as well, almost like a memento of an event that has happened, and the action of painting is the making of it, and once the action is complete, what you're left with then is the ghost, the relic of both the action of the painting, but also the subject itself becomes the ghost. And I have to say, it was quite deflating as I read it. I was sort of both kind of pumped up by the philosophical possibility of it, but then the thought of, crikey, am I, you know, is the work done then? There was an essay doing the rounds when I was at college by Crimp around the death of painting as well, which in a way dovetailed Baudrillard's idea that for various reasons, you know, because of digital technology and the invention of photography, the philosophical position of painting, that painting was done. And I don't think Crimp, like Baudrillard, I don't think the intention was for painters to freak out and stop painting as if to say that the work is done, but to find new ways to respond to how painting has emerged and developed and been understood. And so for my part, I suppose this is my contribution to that conversation, a way to find new approaches to painting, understanding both a historical legacy within still life and landscape painting, but not painting as if it's the 17th century. You know, Quodlibet emerged late 17th, 18th century. And some of the artists at work at that time, like Gilbrecht, who we were talking about, you know, make work that I think is remarkably contemporary now. But our part is to do something new, to continue that conversation. And I hope in some small way that these paintings are able to do that. Perhaps they are both the ghost that Baudrillard describes, but also something else. I kind of like the idea that they're more like the undead, that they are reanimated, somehow alive again beyond the ghost.
And there's a lot of, maybe you can say a bit more about your relation to painting's history. Of course, I mean, Baudrillard is also talking there about the image, I suppose, and maybe someone like Crimp and, you know, and that moment, you know, they're talking about painting and painting's death, and in that was also the relation to the hand, to paintings, you know, sort of you know, relation to other forms of expression and its reaction to those things. And Baudrillard sort of, I think, was interesting about that essay is he's focused very much on the imagery, you know, on the content of the image. But I mean, there's a lot of history. I mean, it's almost like these paintings, you know, condense a lot of paintings' history, both, you know, these Baroque dialogues about metaphysics of painting and image and illusion, which is, and painting's just one response to that, of course. You know, you're talking about Pozzo earlier, or, you know, the ceilings is architecture, really, is space, isn't it? And painting is, in some ways, you can't dissociate the act of painting from the experience of a more holistic spatial architectural space. And then, of course, we have sort of painting, sort of constant sort of back and forth about its own limits in relation to objecthood and, you know, the 20th century in relation to frame, in relation to the painter's studio, the painter's body, the painter's hand, gesture itself. So it seems to me you're pulling a lot of different dialogues from painting's history. Maybe you could say a bit more about that, what the punctums for you in that history are.
Yes, yeah, thank you. Yes, it's interesting, isn't it, how the way that we view a painting is, you know, has changed so much through time, and the way that a painting is manufactured changes. You know, the idea of how an artist, I'm coming to you from my studio now in South London, and if I was painting in the 18th century, I wouldn't be in a studio like this. I don't know where I'd be, maybe a workshop perhaps with lots of people around. I might be working as part of a team of people. I might be the master craftsman, or I might be one of the minions working. And I don't think I'd be making work with such autonomy. You know, I wouldn't have so much autonomy over the kind of painting I'd be making. I might be working to the commission of someone's request, or perhaps as part of a collaborative who are working together with architects and designers to create something together. We've been speaking of, I mentioned that painting in Rome, the Jesuit church, that one looks up and sees the dome. But of course, that painting is made in connection and collaboration with the architect and with designer and with a commissioning agency, all of whom have their agenda and all of whom contribute to that full experience of entering into this space. And this is a very different way of encountering a painting to walking around the National Gallery or the Tate Modern or an independent commercial gallery, or indeed the way that most of us would initially see a painting is probably online, you know, and having something that is backlit on a screen and this big rather than the full experience on a ceiling. You know, all these ways, they change the way that we experience paintings and the way that images function and the power of play at work within that, you know, the power of the artist and the power of the viewer, the commissioning agency and so forth. So I guess in a way these paintings play with the various ways that images might function today and have functioned historically. Some of the works, in fact, bring in historical paintings. One of them has a little nod and a wink to Caravaggio, for example. On the Bewitching Hour, we see a series of drawings at the top right, and one is of Caravaggio. Another is a painting by Edward Collier, a Quadlibet painter, and another still from the Flemish school, late 17th century. And in a way, they almost appear like grace notes in a piece of music, just notes that support the main activity of the music or the main activity of the painting. But here these images are presented as though they're drawings or perhaps they're printouts from a domestic printer, and they're stuck somewhat unceremoniously onto a pane of glass. And the way that one experiences, therefore, these images is very different. You know, the central Caravaggio painting, which would have been painted probably for a private residence. You would have had a private audience with that view. You would have been wealthy to have experienced that painting. And approaching that's very different from the way that I've rendered it, which is a printout from a domestic printer. And when you're done with it, you can scroll up, you can throw it out again. You know, you can use it to kindle your fire, or you can write your shopping list on the back of it. And I wonder how Caravaggio might have felt about the way that we experience that painting now.
That's really interesting. I mean, you know, you talk about power and obviously like the history of imagistic illusions inseparable from power. Talking about, you know, Baroque trompe l'oeil in, you know, in churches and these great sort of, you know, the power of the church, of course, with power of painting over the other arts, that contest, that battle. And it's interesting sort of to think about this genre that some might say, you know, has an anachronistic sort of component to it, as maybe having some, is there some sort of critical power or other type of power left in that gesture of, you know, of sort of the hypermimetic or whatever you want to call it. And I was struck there also by what you said about the space being given, you know, that these are paintings going into a gallery space. And talking about, well, the power of the gallery, you know, the power of a space that's given. And again, talking, you know, thinking about the history of how illusion has been used by painters to subvert and challenge. One way of seeing these paintings is as paintings on a white wall in a gallery space.
Yes.
Another way of seeing these paintings, and it's hard because we're still looking at them on the screen and the physical show hasn't opened yet. But it
yes,
is.
Exactly. Yeah.
is to see them in a studio or to see them on a notice board. Which is a different experience. We talk about immersion. I was always struck when you come across, you know, paintings by Gibrecht and others, that it's that moment of surprise, of shock, when you're in a museum and the eye's been accustomed to the non-ironic sort of history of developing genres, the developing history of painting, responding to its earlier history. And then you have these almost moments of schism, of shock, which are just a break with that and a sort of a real, you know, strong subversion, strong joke with utter seriousness. And the power is in that, is in all the contrast between what's come before and I guess in what might come after.
Yes, I wouldn't have been wonderful to have been in the room when that Gilbrecht painting was revealed. Maybe there was a little curtain constructed and little drum roll, curtain opens, and it's a painting of the back of a painting. That must be just such a lovely moment, and so whimsical and ironic, and maybe even a little postmodern, you know. Yeah, it's a lovely moment, but the thing is, it's so well painted, and you know, it's painted with that same attention as Gilbreth would have given to, and did give to, other earlier forms of the genre painting. And so, yeah, there's a joke, there's a whimsical nature to it, but there's also a sincerity in the way that these works are rendered.
I mean, it is important, like the moment right now, you know, the fact that we are all sort of screen bound. We've been like that for a year. Galleries have been shut. Some of us haven't had access to studios also to make work. And, you know, so there is also that kind of, sort of revealing. You talked about revelation, the curtain going up. Do you think of having a show now and a show of these kind of works in that way? Is there a sort of potency
to the piece? Oh, yeah, I certainly hope so. I feel that sense of expectation in doing a show in the real, and you know, no pressure or anything, but you know, none of us have really had a show in the real for at least a year and a half now. And you know, these are paintings of drawings and sketches I've been making. So in a way, in the last year, I've been making lots of small work, partly, if I'm being honest, for a commercial element, because the larger works have been difficult to sell and exhibit and promote. But also, maybe like a lot of artists, I've found the way that I've painted has changed quite a lot, and energy levels have been really different. And, you know, I've been juggling, have my daughter at home and childcare. I don't have those same epic, you know, 12-hour days to work on 10-foot canvases, you know, that just hasn't been possible. So I've been making small works on paper and collage works. And then this exhibition in some ways is paintings of those works. It's not the works themselves, it's paintings of the works and paintings of the drawings and paintings I've been making, as I say, out in the landscape. So in some ways it's quite a domestic show and you know, an exhibition of very mundane everyday objects, you know, little drawings of the landscape and drawings of drawings that I've made and paintings of my cat. But the thing about the Quadley Bet is that it affords the opportunity to observe the everyday in this greater sense, in this almost kind of metaphysical sense that, you know, there's so much of the wider universe at play in a very small drawing or painting. And even just the very act of making a mark on I do it now in my sketchbook as we talk and I draw, just by making a line in the sketchbook connects with this rich history of drawing and painting and all that involves. And I love that, how a simple mark can be both a mundane, even therapeutic moment, and at the same time resonate with the wider history of Eastern and Western painting. You know, this is the joy and the thrill of being an artist and working in the studio.
As you say, the everyday today at this moment, after the year and a half we've had, takes on a particular pathos, domesticity. The interior takes on a particular tone,
absolutely,
a particular kind of resonance. Beyond the painting, there is a sort of the comment on painting.
Yes.
And the artist in the studio and the place of that after, you know, in our internet, post-internet age, there's also the comment on the domestic, the value of the private. And as you said earlier, this the secret,
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. I wonder if many of us have felt that sense of greater value in the everyday rhythms of life, and you know, with incapacity to travel, particularly overseas, and to operate in normal ways, you know, the little rhythms perhaps that we've built up, you know, the little rituals. When I come to the studio every morning, I light a candle, I have a meditative moment, I drink coffee, and I didn't intend to have that regular rhythm, but it's become part of the daily rhythm of the studio. And that has become quite an important part of my studio day, as important as stretching a canvas or preparatory sketches. And I wonder if we've seen greater value in, you know, a meal with family or with friends, the regular rhythm of what time we go to bed, what time we wake in the morning. These sort of everyday moments that we've come to observe more in the last year. You know, I think reflectively, when one approaches them as a subject in painting, they can be in themselves a philosophical concern or question about the value of the everyday. We use the word mundane negatively somehow, but I think perhaps we might be able to reclaim it as something quite wonderful, you know, the wonder of an everyday moment.
You mentioned scale. So, you know, could you tell us a bit more? I mean, apart from Bewitching Hour that's behind you, and that's a big painting, that's a 2 meter.
Yeah.
What about the others? Are they all private, small, intimate studies?
Yes, and that in some ways, even the big ones are small and intimate because, you know, Jacob's Dream, which is 240 by 120, I think, something like that. That's a big painting to work on, and it takes up most of my main painting wall. But yet inside of that painting are smaller paintings. So you're drawn into an intimate encounter with a replication of a painting that might be a printout or a drawing or a postcard or something like that. So one encounters both the grand scale and the intimate. And the same with the Bewitching Hour. Most of the paintings, I think, operate in that way. So, you know, it's a different experience. When one encounters the large painting, you need to step back. You're a few yards. So there's a distance between you and the painting. You might be invited to come in. And within the genre of trompe l'oeil, there's that element that invites you to come forward to see, am I really looking at what I think I'm looking at? Perhaps a piece of masking tape, a paper plane, a cat's claw. You have to come closer to check what you're looking at and see if it really is real. So it's a device to bring you closer. Mm-hmm. But then also the painting of these smaller replications is equally a device to bring you in. So, you know, I hope that they bring the viewer in. You know, I hope that a kind of larger experience of a painting actually in some ways is demystified as these paintings draw you closer. You have this closer experience.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. That sort of, again, there's a slight subversion of the expectation, you know, of a grand gestural painting. You might think that's in the tradition of, you know, sort of certain types of new figuration, like, you know, in the 80s and 90s. But then having that small postcard there is just, it's a sort of little, you know, it sort of takes us, okay, well, it's not just a big gestural abstraction or,
yes,
you know, quasi-abstraction or anything, you know, or gestural painting. Are these postcards and ephemera things that are there? Does everything here actually exist? Someone might ask.
Yes.
So are we looking at transcriptions of your, I don't know if transcription is the right word, of your studio, say when we look at Jacob's Dream?
Yes, are the things there? Yeah, I love that question. They are. My process involves printing out a lot of images and ideas, and the substrate, the surface, is prepared, whether it's wood or more recently canvas, and then I pin and tape all the printouts onto the surface to find an assemblage, to find a composition that both appears intuitive, perhaps even random, maybe even slightly chaotic, but at the same time there's a sense of cohesion and rhythm, you know, because of my my classical training, so to speak, I can't help but want to look for the compositional devices and a sense of rhythm and harmony in the painting. So they need to appear both randomly assembled, but at the same time, a cohesion and a harmonious assemblage needs to come about. And from there, I'll take photographs of that assemblage and I'll make drawings of that assemblage. And when I think I've got it right, I bring everything off the painting and then refer back to the drawings and the photographs and then recreate the thing on the surface. But I still keep them around, and, you know, a sheet of paper will be taped onto the wall and I'll be observing the way that the light is falling on the paper and the way that the shadow falls to emulate and to replicate the light conditions of that moment and of that time. So in some ways, they're kind of an odd coming together of both an observational painting of the actual objects that exist, but then at the same time, a memory of the replications and that initial montage, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's really useful to hear as well. I mean, Jacob's Dream is interesting because it could be, you know, almost thinking like ARP or something, you know, that sort of just dropping things.
Yeah, yeah,
That random assemblage, that sort of idea of assemblage, or just a snapshot of your wall at a particular time.
Yes.
And you know, and we have to talk also about the range of reference there. You mentioned earlier. You know, we're talking about a painting. It looks to me like a Tintoretto painting. It looks like a Jacob's Dream in San Rocco. But then we got the Gauguin, you know, the sermon, and we've got sort of Hindu deities and other things I can't quite see. But it's a real melange of references that this is an artist's studio, but doesn't necessarily, and they all block the painting.
Yes.
That's odd. Like, why would you put, you know, why are the postcards on top of the painting that you're making?
Yeah. It kind of covers Jacob's face as well, which just seems rude, if nothing else, you know. Yeah. And it is, you're right, it's Tintoretto. Yeah, so it's Tintoretto's painting of Jacob's Ladder. Mm-hmm. And most of the replicated paintings, they relate to that story of Jacob from the Old Testament in the Bible. And it's either the ladder or it's the fight with the angel in the middle of the night. And that reflects, you know, my personal interests and concerns and theological interests too. But then riffing alongside that, you know, you've got a bit of Gauguin in there. So we have the Vision, which is set in Brittany. We have the Breton women there in the foreground, and they look out over and they see Jacob wrestling an angel in the middle of the night. That painting's in Edinburgh, actually. You know, it's in your hometown, and it's one of my favourite paintings. It's one of the paintings that got me into painting. I love the redness of that red grass there, the heat of the situation, and the tree that cuts over the composition, which shouldn't make sense compositionally to do that, but somehow it does. And it splits the painting into two sections, meaning that we sit to the left with the women of Britain, and beyond that we look to this realm beyond where Jacob is wrestling the angel. In some ways that painting acts almost like we're looking through a portal to another realm. And I see that also in the Tintoretto. You know, it's a mural that's in a church. You need to look up to experience it. The painting itself is something like a portal to a world beyond. And my hope is, as you begin to look more closely at that painting, you see various paintings that refer to that idea of the painting as a portal, also referring that story of Jacob.
Yeah, I mean, of course, that's sort of bracketing, the deliberate act of choosing, selecting, you know, could be a critical act. And you did mention the sort of contemporary status of the genre. Of course, we haven't talked about skill and technique yet.
Right, yes.
Yeah. But I'm thinking of, you know, how do you see the place of works like this in the contemporary moment in terms of contemporary, you know, art? I mean, I know that sort of someone who comes to mind is Lucy McKenzie's work. She's some, you know,
yes,
Guadalupe, and in a different way to you. And so, I mean, and there may be others who I don't know about, but then I'm also thinking of the kind of that sort of, you say, hyper-realism in sculpture, like Dwayne Hansen and Ron Yeck and those guys, you know.
Yes.
How do you, you know, do you see this as a sort of intervention into the contemporary field, or, you know, what's that relation like for you?
Yes, very much so. Yes, you mentioned Lucy McKenzie, who's probably perhaps the best known, perhaps in our school and time, of artists working with various forms of trompe l'oeil, and Quodlibet comes in there from time to time. I think of an artist called Keith Goodsford as well, who works in this way. And it's funny, in some ways, it's a bit like, we bought a new car last year. We bought a Golf, and I wasn't aware of people driving Golfs much. And then we got one, and suddenly everybody seems to be driving a Golf. You know, it's like that. You start working in a very specific form of painting, like Quodlibet, and then suddenly you see all these other artists who are working in that field, and one becomes aware of that and thinking, how do I make my work distinctive from that, but also part of a conversation that these artists are having. But I think for many artists who work within this mold or work with illusionism, I think there's a direct parallel. Well, a couple of things, but at first, when Quodlibet painting was emerging, late 17th, 18th, and then into 19th century, there's a parallel with the evolution of printing technology and the point at which images could be readily printed and be made available as political or religious tracts. And that there's a shift then in the way that the wider populace would experience a painting. You know, you don't have to go to a church building or a museum to encounter an image. You can get handed one in the street. You can buy it in the newspaper. And the image then changes function at that point, at least it's the way that its experience changes. And I think of our generation, you know, we're the generation who are engaging and embracing with the digital, of course. And I didn't get my first mobile phone until I was 21. And I don't think I started surfing the internet until I was maybe about 22 or 23. So, you know, we are that generation who are seeing images in a different way now. So to me, the Quodlibet is a way of approaching how images are disseminated, but prior to that, how they're manufactured, how they're reproduced, and then disseminated. And I see that echo of what the Quodlibet artists were attempting to do. Others specifically approach painting in the digital realm. You know, I think others greater than I are doing that. And for me, I'm more interested in what happens with the physicality of an image. So when it gets printed out, or when it gets reproduced in a book or something like that. And then, of course, the painting has that physicality to it as well.
I mean, with McKenzie's work, they've been, if I'm not right or wrong, seen as sort of feminist, also sort of,
yes,
having a sort of feminist critical character to them in terms of the objects chosen, the types of references there. And I'm also struck, you know, that there's always a sense of relation to the notice board.
Yes, exactly.
The notice board, coming back to the sort of letter, but the announcement, the declaration. I see yours as more sort of something more, they're less statements than maybe observation is even the right word, but they seem less stated. You know, here, look at this, but I have to ask you about the masking tape, and I'm sure others. No, because the masking tape, you know, seems to be really crucial, a really crucial aspect of your work, the function, and there's something very distinctive about it. Not about how it's painted. I'm not going to ask you that banal question or anything. But the mere presence of the tape, both as the framing device that is sometimes framing, the device that sometimes is actually the edge, although sometimes it's the broken sign of painting's own internal disruption. So the way the masking tape comes into the painting, you know, on top of the image, Sometimes it's not serving any function at all. So it's like there was an image there, but now it's might have fallen off. So he's looking at Jacob's dream again. He scripts some masking tape and they're not attaching anything. They're just there.
They're just there. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, the masking tape is crucial, isn't it, to the reading of this particular body of work. And it functions very differently to that pinboard scenario that you were describing with Lucy McKenzie's painting. And you're right, you know, that functions like a notice board, almost like a gentle declaration of intent or idea. There's a politicized action in the pinboard, I think. And this is very different to the masking tape. You know, the masking tape, to me, represents more of the artist's process, the way that paintings are made, the way that artists utilize their source materials, the way that the studio works as a manufacturing space for painting. Mm. I've yet to meet a painter who doesn't have rolls of masking tape in their studio and little bits of tape stuck around on the wall where pictures have been pinned or drawings have been put up or to-do lists have been stuck up on the wall. So, you know, the masking tape, you know, it represents a sense of the temporal of the working process, the possibility that something's about to be pulled off the surface, or perhaps it's just been stuck down. So these things are at play. But the masking tape is also a proposal, you know, it's a proposition, if you will, when something is taped to that surface and means by saying, here is an idea that we can discuss, something can begin. And, you know, to me, painting is very much about propositions. You know, let's propose an idea. Let's have some discussion about what might be a possibility. So the tape can afford that. But then, as you describe as well, it's a framing device too. So there are compositional elements. It can be a way of denoting a certain section within a painting. So compositionally, one can put together shape and form that can work. But at the same time, it can be a way of highlighting a certain section of a painting, almost to say, look at this first, here is the section. And in some of these works, including improvisation, we see masking tape around the edge. Likewise, in through a glass darkly, we see tape around the perimeter of the painting, which suggests a frame, but also suggests some kind of work in progress. With this painting, other things are happening as well. That surface presents a bit like a billboard or an old wall, and perhaps a working of an old painting that's been reworked and collaged and stripped back and so forth. And there the tape functions as a way of framing that surface, that proposition.
Of course, it just occurred to me that the paintings are never finished. The paintings are finished, but of the representation of the incompletion, maybe of the act and history of painting.
Yeah. Absolutely. And forever changing their meaning, of course, as they're taken from one context to another context, viewed from one generation to another generation. You know, I think of the way John Berger framed all that as well, in ways of seeing that as one encounters a painting from one generation to the next, it changes. So they're not dead. You know, they're ever evolving and ever animate as the great history of art continues and the way that paintings are viewed continues.
What's interesting is that, of course, when we see paintings digitally,
yeah,
in our image searches, we won't see the masking tape, we won't see the board.
Yes.
We won't see the blue tack and the bit of olive branch, whatever it is. So those are things that actually maybe have become invisible from that, you know, the kind of incessant dissemination, the technical dissemination of images, the circulation. So yes. To see the masking tape is actually reminds us of a place elsewhere, the mm-hmm. place that's not actually part of that circulation.
Mm, that's a wonderful thought. Yes, yeah, that's a lovely way of thinking about the masking tape. I think of an artist, Sylvia Plumick-Mangold, who worked, I think, the 70s and 80s, who also employs the illusion of masking tape in her work. And much of her later work is driven by landscape too. And they might appear to be works in process, works that are never finished, or works that might be about to be finished. So it's like you're having some insight into the artist's working process. And in a way, you know, it's a very brazen thing to exhibit a painting that presents itself as unfinished. You know, there's something quite bold about that. But also, I think quite humble as well, you know, to present a work as something that's not complete, you know.
Well, Alistair, I think we've had it's been a really rich conversation, and there's a lot more I want to probe you on, and I think we'll continue talking after this discussion, but maybe we should draw it to close there for now.
Yeah, thank you, Camille, so much for the conversation and for the opportunity to talk about the painting. It's a privilege for an artist to be able to be interviewed and talk about their work. So I thank you for that, and lovely to talk with you.
Thank you.